Sure.
What has baseball meant to you all of these years?
Yeah, that is broad, but it, to me it's kind of narrow, because it is. It's been, you know, I knew my dad played ball. He signed at 44, and he played, but until I got to a certain age, I really didn't know what that meant. And back then, there was no way to even find out. He didn't play in the big leagues. There was no record of. He didn't keep a lot of things in the house, but we knew he played ball. You know, we knew he. At that time, we had a family business that was surrounded. It was basically the rendering business, mm-hmm. And because of that. And then when me and my brother started playing Little League, it seemed like it attracted other people, mostly Italian guys, to be honest. And my dad's best friends were Charlie Silvera, caught backup for the Yankees for years. Sal Tarmino, who was probably his closest friend and roommate with the San Francisco Seals. At that time, Sal was the coach of Santa Clara. My dad's quartermaster in the Navy. Was Patty Cottrell, who coached Santa Clara to the World Series and was a great local scout that scouted for years and years. And so those people were around your life, and they were baseball people. So there was only two kinds of people that seemed to be around, you know, the business people and it seemed like a lot of baseball people. So to say what it's meant is probably the only thing it's meant. You know, it's been our life, and obviously, I've been making a paycheck since I was 18, so it's been my adult life. Yeah.
So, after all these years in the game, what motivates you now?
Honestly, to take care of my family, get the kids through college, and maybe start a small business, which is almost impossible these days, especially in California. But find their way in life, and keep supplying, you know, money to be quite honest, and earn a living so they can get off to a good start, and then we'll see where it leads. But the passion of the game is something that's built in. You don't have to look for it. It's there, the motivation to help somebody. Just as you walked in the door, Posey asked me a simple question about Johnny Cueto. It's his first game with us. We know he's faced Milwaukee quite a bit. Just a in-game and pre-game kind of strategy, you know, something like that keeps you motivated as a coach, because you know you're needed, I guess, and we're not holding towels and hitting fungos. We're actual people that these guys feel like we can help.
As you look back on your career, either as a pitcher or as a coach, are there certain things that stand out to you, specific memories?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. When I go to bed at night, whether I was having trouble sleeping or not, over the years, two things dominate my sleep or pre-sleep, because I'm not asleep, right? One is I try to get on a golf course and I play hole by hole and try to map. And sometimes I'll make it to the second hole. Sometimes I'll go right through the hole 18 and never fall asleep. And I do that. And the other ones, believe it or not, I try to change history, which is impossible, but my only shot at pitching in the World Series, a one game, one shot that I had, didn't go well. And I try to rewrite that in my head. And I swear to you, it's at least three times a week I do that. And we lost the World Series in 2002. And I think about that. Isn't that terrible? I should be thinking about the wins and the wonderful times. But
when was the game that didn't get you into the World Series that you're talking about?
It was in the World Series. It's game three against Valenzuela and the Dodgers. I was with the Yankees, and we lost 5-4, and I didn't pitch well. I came out in the third or fourth inning, and it really came down to one pitch in the first inning, and I was trying to pitch around Ron Say with an open base and left-hander on deck, Rick Monday. No easy batter, but the advantage, I had a little bit of advantage since he hadn't faced me yet. I wasn't behind him, so I made a bad pitch to Say. The one pitch that I controlled the best was my fastball, and I pulled the darn thing over the heart of the plate a little bit, and he took me deep. And that's the pitch because I had a natural movement away from righties, and if you just relax and throw it, 99 out of 100, for whatever reason, I like I tried to straighten it out and make sure I kept it away, and I actually cut it. I actually pulled on it, and which you can do. And I think about it a lot.
So you think of that, not the no-hitter on July 5th, 1983 against the Red Sox.
I know, it's stupid, right? But many people do remember. If I'm out in the street or doing anything and meet somebody, it's amazing. But that game comes up at least once or twice a week.
I remember Italy. Sure. As a Red Sox fan.
Yeah. I'll bet. It's probably the last. I don't know if the Red Sox have been no-hit since. Have they?
Yeah, Chris Bosio.
Well, Bosio did it, that's right, a fellow Italian.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
So we're...
forgot, in Seattle.
Right.
Okay.
Who are some of the toughest hitters you've faced in your career?
Well, since we're sitting in Milwaukee, it starts with Yount Molitor. Ooh. Actually, Cecil Cooper, too, because Cecil, he'd take his shot, try to pull, but after I faced him a few times... He stopped trying to do that unless he was way ahead in the count. He was perfectly fine about driving me or hitting the ball the other way and finding a way to get on base. Paul Molitor, Robin, obvious, for obvious reasons. George Bell hit me good. Once I became a reliever, I became a little streamlined as a pitcher. I didn't use all four pitches. I was worried about giving it up in the ninth inning with a changeup or something, and that wasn't one of my main pitches. But so when those great hitters really could just think about me throwing hard slider or hard fastball, it actually became a lot tougher for me to pitch. When I was a starter, it was easier for me to face those kind of guys. But they stick out. Manny Lee probably got the most hits off me, believe it or not. He didn't play all the time, but it seemed like he got plenty of hits off me, you know, the Cal Ripkins, Eddie Murray's. Our division was, I think, the greatest and one of the greatest in baseball from the late 70s all the way into the 90s. The Red Sox, Tigers, Blue Jays. Cleveland was tough. Even they just didn't have a lot of pitching, but they always had a lot of hitters. The Red Sox, of course, with Rice and Evans and Boggs and Greenwell. Pretty good. Yeah. Pretty damn good. So, yeah, is that good? That's good enough, right? Yeah. These guys were good.
Talk about the transition. It was Yogi that got you to go into the bullpen, right?
How did he made the call, yeah.
Yeah. What was the reasons that he gave you? How did that come about?
Well, the reason was pretty simple. The day before, Goose Gossage had left for free agency to go to San Diego. And back then, it wasn't like it is now. They didn't have some kid in the minor leagues prepped to be a closer.
Right.
I think they asked Guidry first, and Gator said, no, I'm going to want to keep starting. Back then, and even now, if you're a starter, you made twice as much money, too. I wasn't in that kind of position. I was only in my second or third full year.
Yeah.
The phone rang the next day. And I remember my father telling me, they're going to ask you. And it was a three, for whatever reason, I don't know if they were in the room or they were on the speakerphone, which back in 1984, I didn't know what the hell that was, but Sammy Ellis and Murray Cook was our interim, or our new GM. He wasn't there for long as a GM, but Jeff Torborg was involved with the decision too. And when Yogi called, I felt like I couldn't say no. There was nothing I really could say. Now, from there, I just heard tons of grumbling. No, he should do it, shouldn't do it. You know, I did it because I trusted Yogi. He wanted me to do it.
Not both.
He was a brand-new manager because Billy just got fired. And so I agreed to do it. When I got to spring, it got worse because now the reporters got involved. Every day it carried the story in spring training to the point where I got tired of it, you know, and I just said, hey, you know, I'm doing whatever they want me to do. And, you know, am I happy about it? Hell, you're making me the closer of the New York Yankees. It's not like, to me, I thought it was an incredible compliment, but I felt uncomfortable because there's a lot of veteran relievers and I was a young guy, and now I'm in the pen. I'm supposed to be the man and all that. I had to earn it, right? And so that was the gist of pretty much everything that happened. But it was it never stopped for till the day I left the Yankees. Every year they tried to put me back in as a starting pitcher. Yeah,
is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah. There was always talked about. Yeah. So I never made it. The fans and people didn't really accept me as a reliever and didn't ever thought it was a good idea. Our starting pitching really wasn't very deep for the next few years. And I think it affected it. There was a period of time where we couldn't get those free agents that were prime. We'd get guys that were kind of beat up already, been through some things, and we just missed on that during that period of time because we had maybe the best offense you could put together. We had a hell of a ball club for a lot of years. In fact, we ended up winning the most games in the 80s, but we, of course, didn't win a World Series.
So do you mean with your record, there were still people doubting that you should be the closer?
Oh, absolutely. Even including Billy, every time Billy would take over, I think there was a point, and this is old school methods, that to prove a point, you'd actually go too far the other way, like overuse me to the point where I'm tired. If you look at my first 5 years in the pen, as a closer, I probably threw more innings than any American League pitcher and probably as many games as anybody in baseball. And I think outside of Craig Lefferts, I think in the National League, because we talked about Lefferts, this is the only reason why I know it, and then I ended up looking it up. But for those 5 years, 84 through about 89, me and him had the most. And I was supposed to be a closer. I was supposed to be pitching less, but I actually threw a lot more.
So were you going more than one inning? Were you still in the
I averaged close to 100 innings a year those first 5 years. My first, what saved me from 100 innings 1 year is I accidentally sliced my finger open in the bullpen one day on a water cooler, fooling around talking, and sliced it perfectly right in the knuckle, right in the wrong spot on my left hand. So I couldn't go to the All-Star game. Steinbrenner was a little hot. And that was the year the Tigers went out 35-5. He blamed it on me. He thought, Jesus, we can't. So anyway, that kept me from throwing 100-plus innings that year. I still ended up with about 95. So we were doing a lot of, we were carrying a heavy load then.
So were you routinely pitching more than one inning?
Oh, yes. Pretty obvious. I think I threw 70 games. Yeah. 66 games and threw 100 innings, so I'd say almost three-quarters or a third of my games were probably multiple innings. Yeah, so that's why the high back then, a lot of relievers carried a lot of decisions, 10-plus every year. I mean, 1 year I had 19 decisions, so it was 12-7 or whatever I was. So, yeah, you just expected to be ready from the sixth inning on. Yeah.
The role has obviously changed.
Yeah, it's well. Yeah, back then they carried 10 pitchers. 11 was the big deal, and 12, forget it. They never did that, and they'd wear three of us out pretty much every game. There was always two or three guys with close to 100 innings on most staffs, and it's just the way it was. What are you going to do?
What about Yogi as a manager?
We didn't get a chance to enjoy him long enough. 84, he had a nice year. We ended up winning 90 games. And then I don't know what the deal was. We brought Ricky Anderson in. He got hurt in spring. I don't know if people remember this, but Ricky got hurt sliding. In fact, he tried to slide feet first, and he hurt his ankle. I never forget it. And whatever reason, we got off to a bad start. We were about 15 or 17 games into the season in Chicago, and they fired Yogi. And, that was a big deal. Billy came back in. Players were upset because Yogi never did anything that would make you want to feel like you wanted to do that. We all felt like we let him down. And that turned out to be not a crowning moment, but a tough moment in Yankee history, to be honest. Yogi left the team and never came back for about 20 years. So it was a trick team for sure. So that was a big moment. We didn't know it at the time. We thought we'd see him again. But we didn't. But that was a big deal. We ended up winning about 95 or 97 games that year. And coming in, that wasn't good enough. And I don't know who won in 85. Oh, Toronto. Toronto had a hell of a club. And it was sad because we really handled the Royals very – we beat them up pretty good that year. And the last couple of years, we had a lot of left-handed pitching, and it could at least slow down George Brett in the lineup. And it definitely helped us against them. And our speed had picked up, and we could play on the Astros turf a lot better than we could before.
How about Billy as a manager?
Oh, gosh. Well, I had him four times in four different periods. But he didn't change much in terms of his attitude towards the game and how he managed it. Very aggressive. I think people see him on the field bombastic and doing those things that he did. They show that a lot, but he never saw that in the clubhouse. He never had big meetings. I only remember one meeting other than the normal, let's go, come on, guys, you know, you're Yankees and all this and that. It was a tough time. There was a lot of free agents on the teams, especially our team. And it was tough bringing them all in to be Yankees all the time. Later on, it became a little easier when Joe Torre took over and the things calmed down. But during that period, it was tumultuous. And so I guess in the boss's eyes, you bring in a guy like heavy-handed like Billy or a Lou, and then back off and go somebody like Bucky Dent or you know, the Bob Lemons of the world. You know, I think he always tried to do that, go hard, Dallas Green, and then go soft. You know, it seemed like a pattern, and it was a lot of patterns. But Billy, I personally enjoyed it. I was close to him and his family, and he took care of me in a sense. But he did that because, too, one, I was Italian, I think, a little bit, but the other one, I was willing and able, you know, and good, to be quite honest. And he was pretty tough on guys that weren't at their best, to be honest. Mm-hmm. He didn't know how to take those guys and make them better. Mm. Those are the guys he always lost on a ball club. And they thought they could just interchange those. Instead of making them better and making our whole team better, he kind of lost those guys during the course of the season. But he still won. And he won a lot.
Yeah. He had a reputation for being tough on pitchers, though, didn't he? Is that justified?
Well, most of them were. Most managers weren't ex-pitchers, so most of them didn't like pitchers, especially those guys in that time. And my father told me that at a young age. He goes, we're out there playing our ass off, and the pitchers are in there eating sunflower seeds. And back then they didn't go in the clubhouse like they do now. But I can imagine if I was playing every day and I saw some pitcher with his hat off and his feet kicked up on the railing, and you know, I wouldn't like it either. So I always understood that. I didn't have any problem with that. That's why being a reliever kind of appealed to my baseball background. I felt more like a player, like an everyday player. And Billy was tough. You know what? He used the whatever the strength of the team was. If it was the bullpen, he rode it. If it was the starters, he rode them. And if you look at his background of his career, you can see that in the stats.
They tended to wear out his welcome with managing him, though, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm sure he did. I didn't have any dealings with that, of course, but I knew that happened. He would use that to fuel the trying to make us against them, so to speak, and make George them. And George was used to being that guy. So I think they, you know, it was easy for a manager to play that card, so to speak, sure, and unite the players in a cause against one guy, you know, but that does wear you down, right? It blew up in the A's. But see, the one thing George did and Mr. Finley didn't do with the A's was George paid, where Finley was cheap,
right,
and lost great players. Instead of paying them, keeping them there, and still running that heavy hand, guys would accept that. But if you're not going to pay me and you're going to treat me this way, I'll see you later. Right. You know.
But the A's won in spite of that.
They only did for a while, then it blew up. Yep. And that's why it blew up, because they lost those great players.
Billy was pretty open about being Italian.
Italian-Portuguese, yeah.
Yeah.
That was in our area, that was a big deal. A lot of packing companies, fruits and prunes and cherries, apricots, a lot of San Jose, the valley was just full of orchards, and it was full of Italians and Portuguese and, of course, Mexican and most nationalities that you can imagine. And they were very prideful in our area. That seemed like everybody I knew was of those ethnicities, yeah.
So how did you get into coaching? When did you decide that you wanted to do that?
Well, I was home. Gary Hughes, the great scout who's still with the Boston Red Sox today, was a scout with the Yankees then back in the late 70s. First met, he was from Santa Cruz area and a Bay Area guy. He called me up about a year after I'd been out and say, hey, let's go to Candlestick and watch a game. I said, I'm not going up there to watch a game. He goes, no, you can just hang out with me. And we'll... I said, man, does he want me to scout or something? He says, no, we'll just watch a game together. We'll get something to eat, just hang out. I, you know what? It seemed like a nice thing to do. Plus, I like being around Gary, so it was an easy thing to do. And we went to a game, and before the game, like Gary likes to do, he'd take you down by the dugout, see some guys he drafted and coached. And as a GM of Florida, I knew he knew Robbie Nen and Mark Gardner. And, Danny Darwin was on the Giants then and one of my first roommates with Texas. And I was saying hello, saw Dusty. And next day my phone rang, Sabian had called. Brian Sabian was the new GM of the Giants. And said, what, you want to go down as instructionally coach? I said, what? I said, this whole thing a plan, you know? I said, no, geez, I don't know, Sabes. I don't know if I want to do something like that. He goes, well, I talked to Robbie Thompson, and me and Robbie were close. And he said, well, Robbie says he'll go down if you go down. Well, I didn't know till later that they told Robbie the same thing. If you go down, Rags will go down. So when I agreed to go, I thought I'd be going down just feel it out or whatever. And I got there, and there was one pitching coach back then. Strux League wasn't as big as it is now in terms of numbers. It was still run almost like one team, a team and a half. And Brian Hickerson, who was the pitching coach then, decided to leave. He went to Africa on a mission. And right in the middle of the whole thing. Next thing I know, I've never coached a day in my life. And now I'm running in Strux League. So I did a lot of listening. Acted like I knew what I was doing. And just whatever instincts I had built up, tried to get to know the guys. And the next year, spring came around, they offered me the roving job. I thought that'd be great since three of the teams were in California, Fresno, Bakersfield, and San Jose. We had the one team in Shreveport. And our rookie team was up in Salem, Washington. I said, well, that can't be too bad. And so I just bought myself a big Suburban and did a lot of driving. I didn't fly to those places. I get in my car a day early and just drive easy and go through my San Jose where I was living. And, you know, I said, this is not bad. And I enjoyed it. I dove in head first and I was hooked. And unfortunately, that next instructional league, Brian called again and called me and Robbie Thompson, and he called us over the phone instructionally. We were on a pay phone. I never forget it. And he said, well, we're going to liquidate your jobs. I said, well, that means they're melting, right? They were going to take away the roving, I think, save money in the minor leagues. And he goes, well, you're either out of their job or you can go to the big leagues. I went, what? So here are my instructionally. I got 1 year, still haven't run my own team really. And they want me to be the big league pitching coach. And I wasn't in a position really to turn it down. Unfortunately, I didn't negotiate very well. And I made the same thing that I was making as a rover. But that changed after that. But that's how I got into it. And I've been doing it ever since.
How long had you been coaching before you got called up to the big league?
A season and a half. Yeah.
So did you get the call before the season started?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That winter, I didn't know what I was going to do. I went home wondering what the hell I was going to do. I said, yeah, I'd do it. And I called Dusty, and I knew some of the pitchers, but... You know, I tried to get a feel for what was going on with the club and this and that. And I knew the way I came up, and it wasn't the way the guys were doing it at this point. But I had Ron Paranoski as a mentor, and Ron was stepping down, but he was kind of still there to help me. He ran spring training with me. Every morning I just sit with him, and he would map out an easy way to go through the camp, and don't be afraid to delegate authority, which is what I did. Every pitching coach I've ever had come into spring, I have total autonomy. Let them do their thing and be a coach. So I can trust. Just let me know what the hell you tell them. Other than that, I want all the guys to know we're on the same page, so we know immediately if we're wrong. Mm-hmm. If we got a bunch of guys telling a kid something, which one is he listening to? Which one is he not listening to? Is he tuning something? You don't know that if everybody's on a different page. When everybody's together, even if we're wrong, we'll know immediately if we're wrong. I mean, otherwise, it takes you too long to figure out all these problems, and all you're doing is losing games and losing a player. So that's kind of my only philosophy I've kept.
Was there any coach you had you modeled yourself after, or when you became a coach yourself?
More of a hybrid. Paradonsky was obviously hands-on, but I've learned from all of them, from the guys that were totally hands-off, but like the Art Fowlers of the world that were really old school as you can possibly be, to Stan Williams, who was a power guy. Sammy Ellis probably taught me more about my delivery than anybody, who coached for years and years and with the Yankee system, then the Reds, Seattle. And, he had Bosio, who we talked about earlier, Randy Johnson, people like that. But so those guys are the main guys. Mark Connor, who's been a minor league coach for 1,000 years and helped Buck Showalter start the D-backs. And then every guy in the league. I watch pitching coaches from all over the league, and a lot of them are lefties. A lot of them are former Yankees or play with the Yankees. You know, you have the Honeycutts and Prices, or now as a manager, of course, Ray Surge. And I'd be missing out if I missed all the names, but a lot of guys that are friends of mine and mentors, and you just listen to them, and I watch the way they coach. That they're telling me by the way they coach and how they're teaching tall guys. We're teaching big, tall guys now, you know. And so you watch that. So, you know, I watch, you know, those kind of guys. And we got – our division's full of great coaches, and it has since I got in the division. And, that's pretty much what I do.
You mentioned Chris Bosio, but you were coaching long before Chris became a coach, right?
Probably not a long time, but – yeah, I saw Chris. Chris lived up in Sacramento for a while in El Dorado Hills. And so I played in his golf tournament. And I got to know Chris and Matt Sinatra, used to be teammates in this World Series of Golf thing that got started in the late 80s. And I played in every one of them for about 15 years. So I got to know Chris really well. And we still talk. And just talked to him the other day about some advice, about some stuff. And we all text each other. Dave Island had won the World Series. We had beat them the year before. We were teammates with the Yankees. You know, I was really happy for him. And their third base coach, Mike Dursley, was we signed together in 1977 with the Texas Rangers. So, you know, there's ties all over the game, and you love beating them. But, you know, you don't have a problem shaking their hand and wishing them well.
Go back to the beginning. When did you start thinking about playing professionally? How did that happen?
I never did. My brother was the player. I was skinny. I don't look like it now, but I entered high school. We had a three-year high school, so I entered as a young kid. Born early in November, so I was younger than everybody else, but I was 5'3" on my driver's license. At 135 pounds, and stayed that way for quite a while. So I didn't do a hell of a lot. I sat on the bench in my sophomore year as a basketball player and as a baseball player. I grew a little bit my junior year, and I actually made the varsity. I played left field, played the whole year, hit about 240 or something, but made all the plays and had a great arm. But again, I was skinny, and they called me bacon legs. I had real skinny legs. I could swim like a son of a gun, but I wasn't getting in those Speedos for nothing. And I could run. And I could run all day, of course, at a stride, and I only carried a certain amount of weight. So there wasn't much I could do. Between my junior year and senior year, I grew. I finally got to about 6'1", and I got a little stronger. So they let me pitch that summer in American Legion ball. And I was getting older men out, older guys out, 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds. And, facing guys like Carney Lansford and people like that who were a few years older than me. And, you know, I started getting confidence. I went back my senior year and pitched, and I had a pretty good year. I was wild, just learning how to control my fastball. And a bunch of us decided to go to junior college together at San Jose City College, and John Olin was the manager. John was a roommate of my father's in AAA with Seattle Mariners and won a pennant when Freddie Hutchinson was their manager. And John Olin was a left-handed pitcher on that staff with the Reds back in the late 50s. Or, middle 50s, 55, I think they won it. So I figured, hey, it'd be a good place to go. He's a lefty and this and that. But Rick Raich was his local coach, who was a left-handed pitcher himself. He taught me my first mechanics of really understanding my body. And, they, of course, back then they just made us run. So I kind of hated it. But all my friends were on the team, about five of us from the same high school. My brother was there. And within, honestly, in that November, so maybe 2 months of pitching, the coach came up to me and said, you know, you're going to get drafted. And I went, oh, Christ. So, because I thought I was in the Army. There was a draft going on still. And I said, oh, my gosh. So it was a small draft. I think the major one was over. This is 77, so it was the winter of 76. So it was. I think it was still going on. But anyway, I thought it was going on. And he says, no, dummy, you're good at baseball. I said, really? Well, I was wondering why he told me in that respect and not a scout or find out when the draft came along. Back then there was a winter draft in January. They called it the secondary phase. And then I found out these scouts started coming up to me saying, you're going in the first round. And my coach got involved, but he probably shouldn't have been doing that. He was trying to keep me in school, of course, another year. And I just remember all these teams wanted to privately work me out and stuff. I didn't know if it was legal or not, but Charlie Silvera, who I mentioned early, was still catching, believe it or not, back then. He must have been in his late 50s, I imagine. And I threw to him at Buckshaw Stadium in Santa Clara. And Patty Cottrell was there. And Bill White, the old left-handed reliever pitcher with the New York Yankees. And he was with Atlanta, and so was Charlie as a scout. And Atlanta was going to draft me number one, and they wanted to work me out and offer me $20,000. I said, what? What? You know, and back then, that was kind of the staple number because you got all this $7,500 for all the bonuses for A-ball, AA, and AAA. When you made it to the big leagues, you got $7,500. So they're basically paying you $12,500, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, of course, said no and didn't do it. And I wanted to go to school because I didn't quite think I was ready. And I knew I signed after my season was over. I didn't have to go to spring training. I could immediately go to eight ball and jump ahead, maybe a rookie ball. And the other part of the caveat was my brother was going to get drafted too, which turned out to be some threats. Texas said they wouldn't draft my brother unless I signed. And so they used me against my older brother. Atlanta lost. I would have signed with Atlanta, but Atlanta lost their Ted Turner had tampered in the Gary Matthews free agent from the Giants, and they fined him a first-round draft pick, and it turned out to be me. And so instead of going to Atlanta back then and being with, I think Thane was there as a pitching coach. A lot of good pitchers came out of there in the late 70s, early 80s. And I signed basically so my brother could sign, and that's all I got was that $20,000. So my coach told me, don't sign for anything less than 50. The number one guy in the summer was Goodwin. I don't know if you remember, he's a hitter from the Minnesota Twins and the Angels. He got drafted number one 2 years in a row, which was almost incredible. And Danny Goodwin was his name. He ended up being a DH type, but sorry to go on and on. But I ended up signing so my brother could play, and he ended up playing 3-4 years. Of course, I got traded to the Yankees soon after. But that's how it all got started.
Wow.
So sorry to ramble. But
no, it's great.
So your brother got how far?
He went to A-ball. He tore up most of his arches and his feet, stress fractures. And they tried to make him a catcher. He's a third baseman, shortstop. He was a big, big, heavy-legged guy, could swing the bat, but they tried to catch him. He just broke down, and he didn't have any money behind him. They signed him for $500. And soon he was gone, done. He had a shot at coaching, but he went home to coach instead to work in the family business. And he's still coaching to this day, so it's been a good thing. Yeah.
Was your father a supporter of you playing ball?
Yeah, he seemed to be. I think he thought we'd both be home in a few years, like we all were back then. He always thought I was. He never said it out loud to me, but he thought he knew I had the things below your belt, you know, the guts for it and all that. But he didn't think I was strong enough really to maintain a long career because I was built much like he was. But I ended up filling out and finally getting up to about 200 pounds. And that was no weightlifting, of course. We didn't have weight rooms. But, I definitely was stronger in the ass and in my legs. And I was lucky. I could pitch all day.
So how was from the time you were Blaine, and now you see everything as a coach, but how much has the game changed, if it has?
If you really don't pay attention to some things and keep it as simple as bats, balls, the bases are the same, the plate, the umpires. If you keep it like that, it hasn't changed a bit. There's always been pockets of ebbs and flows in terms of run production. It's up, it's down, the balls are harder, softer, the whatever, all that crap. No AstroTurf now, which is a major change in the game. They could talk about everything else, but without the AstroTurf, the game's changed dramatically. Speed became less, and quickness, and of course, became less important. And it seems like still swinging a bat is, and strength is first and foremost on everybody's mind. But the pitching's changed where they actually care about pitchers now. Before, they cared about the guys that were helping them win, and that's about it. We'll get another guy. That's just the way it was. And now they try to take care of every kid. As you know, if you go to any kind of minor league park, or you can go to the lowest of the lowest teams, and they got full spreads in the kitchen. They got nutritionists. They got workout guys. They got trainers for every player. You know, that part has all changed. But if you keep it simple, the grass and the mound and the field and the players just playing, it hasn't changed a hell of a lot.
What about the so-called epidemic of shoulder injuries, Tommy John surgery with pitchers?
Well, I think just being around it, seeing it, these guys are much stronger. They use, if you watch, they don't even wind up anymore. Half the guys, I just watched Noah Syndergaard take 3-inch step back, turn, lift his leg, and throw 99 miles an hour, and he's a starter.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how long he's going to do it. God bless him. I hope he does it forever. But it's amazing the less amount of momentum we use as pitchers now.
Yeah.
And especially out of the stretch. We got bigger men pitching ever before. And guys are trying to abbreviate their deliveries because they want to speed up the game. If a guy was a total base dealer, he got 5 to 10 throwovers, you know, and you just tired his ass out. And nobody booed. Everybody knew it was part of the game. They called you chicken and this and that. But that was the strategy. But now an umpire would scream at you. You don't even see a manager throw over 3 times in a row now. It's amazing how everybody wants to get somewhere in a big darn hurry these days. And that has really affected the pitcher, the lowering of the mound. It's down, but it's still, the fields aren't humpbacked anymore, so you're measured by a flat surface out there, the ground, the grass leading up to the mound, and now you have a mound sticking up. But before you had a humpback, and now the mound is on top of the humpback. So you can measure it from almost, you know, you can measure it from home plate, and you can finagle things, lower home plate, try to get some trajectory on a baseball instead of everything being so flat. And that's why you get all these sinker guys, cutters, and the change up dramatically changed the game in the last 20 years. But the overhand curveballs lost art. And it's still the one pitch these guys. They'll go in there all day and hit and never see a curveball.
Yeah.
And most of the time they take them, you know. And You know, you just don't see guys throwing them. You just see these guys bigger and stronger. These guys are monsters in terms of strength.
Sure.
And I think it's just too much for the tendons and the... But there's not a lot of shoulder injuries compared to the elbow. The elbow's much higher.
Right.
Yeah, we tore out our shoulders. You know, for good.
Do you ever think about that it might be advantageous to go back to more of a wind-up?
I sure hope so. The problem is teaching a guy once he's already got to the big leagues. You can't. That's almost too late.
Right.
Unless the guy's real loosey-goosey and a good athlete, you've got to do this since you were a young kid. The Timmy Lincecums of the world, you're not going to see this very much. Now, yeah, if they're pitching that much, they might be gassed out by the time they get to the big leagues. If they go through a whole college four-year program, then minor leagues. They've shown lots and lots of innings by the time they... A lot of us, younger guys my age, if you talk to the guys, they all were different. They played other sports. They played other places on the field. They were probably the shortstop or the center fielder.
Yep.
And now you got guys streamlined just in one... You know, these kids are in high school. They throw maybe 50 innings in 3 years and get drafted and go to college. And, you know, they don't even pitch. And they just save their arms. And it's amazing. They get four-year scholarships. So you'll see guys won't even pitch but a few times every year. You know, they base it on the size and the arm. It's a different game now with all the travel ball and all this. It's so that all that has changed, but we try to keep it simple once the game gets out here on the grass.
Who are some of the either when you were playing or as a coach, exceptional pitchers that you've seen?
Oh gosh,
in your career. I know there've been a lot.
Yeah, one thing that just jumped into my head right away is the lack of left-handed touch pitchers. Every team had at least two of them, maybe three or four if you count the bullpen guys, the long guy. I look here in Milwaukee, I'm in my eyes, I'm seeing Mike Caldwell. I'm seeing Jamie Easterly. I'm seeing Bobby McClure. I go to Boston, I see Hurst and Ojeda and Bobby Tudor and Bobby Sproul, who guys don't remember. You know, I mean, every team. The Yankees had Tommy John. Larry Kerr was in the league. Jeff Zons. These guys flourished all over baseball. That's why Keiko's doing so well. He's good. But people aren't used to seeing that. Left-handed movement away from the bat. You know, curveballs, sinkers. That game, that part of the game, is you don't see that. There's not enough of it. I saw Seaver. I didn't get to see Bob Gibson, but I played with Jim Cotton at that time, had 250 wins. I played with Louis Tion, who probably had the same. I played with Phil Negro, had 300. The Dave Stewarts, the Eckersleys, top of the game guys, right? Ron Guidry, the year I got there, he won 25 games. Bruce Gossage, people like that. I was lucky to see the Lee Smiths, and who I think is Hall of Famer. You don't see all these great pitchers, Blylevin. Saw him in his prime. He was in Cleveland, believe it or not. Him, Sutcliffe, and Denny were all there together. They were all Cy Young guys, and I think they still probably lost close to 100 games. It's amazing. I don't know if you remember that year, but it was somewhere in the 80s. You know, they stick out. Those Dink Clements, when he came up, and Gooden at the same time. And to me, one of the greatest. I was fortunate enough to be in the 86 All-Star game, and they faced each other in Houston, Rogers' home state. To me, that was the most electric game I've ever been a part of. For me, it was my first All-Star game. I, for a couple of years, couldn't go because of injuries and different things. And to see that, I don't know if you remember that, but that was when Teddy Aguirre struck out a bunch of guys. And Valenzuela set the record like five or six in a row.
Yes.
And Clemens and Gooden were just off the charts. You know, that was... And that guy right there pitched, Mike Kukro. And I'm lucky to get in the game myself. And we ended up winning 2-1 or 3-2, I think it was. But so I guess in that game, I could say Mike Scott, you know, was in that game. So that was it was a pretty good group of guys.